this week. Gold blasted higher by the biggest clip in 6 months. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, here back with you this weekend. We've got a big show with two must-hear discussions. The author of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, arguably an investment classic, Professor Burton Malkiel from Princeton University, outlines his most recent Wall Street Journal article on U.S. equities. He likes Dr. Shiller's CAPE Index, a price-to-earnings metric which shows that U.S. equities are extremely overvalued relative to historical norms, similar to 1929 and 2008, and we all know how well those markets ended. He offers an alternative, emerging market shares, which have half the CAPE levels of U.S. equities, presenting what he thinks is an ideal value opportunity. Then David Morgan, the silver investor, joins the show. He thinks U.S. share prices could enter a correction this year, and oil expenses make precious metal shares the investment du jour for 2015. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest editorial report. The show begins now with the market recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited this week over the precious metals exchanges, despite news of another record high in the U.S. dollar index, which finished at a 12-year record. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold picked up $34, about 3%, ending at $12.23 an ounce. Silver added 74 cents, 5% in a single week, at $16.52 on Friday. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index finished at the highest point in 12 weeks, up 8%. That's 5.5 points at 76 on the index. And then West Texas Intermediate crude continued its frightening decline, off about $5, 8% for the week, ending at $48.21 a barrel. Well, the top stories impacting the exchanges this week included better-than-expected unemployment numbers from the Labor Department and the Fed's latest meeting minutes. Employment rose more than expected, and the jobless rate declined to the lowest level since at least June of 2008, wrapping up at 5.6%. The December employment report registered an increase of about 250,000 jobs, and there were upward revisions for both November and October. In related news, the latest FOMC meeting minutes were released this week, which indicated concerns by Fed governors over low inflation rates, implying perhaps deflation is on their minds, keeping them up at night. The Fed Bank of Atlanta president, Dennis Lockhart, noted how strong jobs numbers did little to impact his opinion regarding rate increases by the summer of 2015. And of course, Fed Chair Dr. Yellen noted that the central bank would likely hold rates steady through April. Yet not all of the Fed officials are so hawkish. One dove held out. Charles Evans, the president of the Chicago Federal Reserve, noted on CNBC that the U.S. central bank should wait until 2016 to raise short-term interest rates. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, the U.S. dollar rally did lose some steam finally after 7 months of gains. That helped send, I think, the precious metals sharply higher. One underreported component, though, I think, to this rally stems from the sharp U.S. equities sell-off this week. When investors lose faith in stocks, capital flows seem to move directly to the precious metals. For next week's forecast and all of the stock picks and portfolios, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account on Sunday and Monday. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, clouds appeared over the New York Stock Exchange for the second week running. The Dow lost about 95 points, half a percent, finishing at 17,731. The S&P was off about 13, ending at 2044, while the Nasdaq was down about half a percent, finishing up at 4704. Stocks started the new year with a powerful wave of selling, which sent the Dow down about 700 points before making a sharp recovery into the weekend. Investors were simply disappointed, I think, by the stronger-than-expected jobs report. Having factored in a perfect world scenario, investors bought the rumor, but then seemed to have sold the numbers this week. The Labor Department showed the unemployment rate came in at 5.6%. Employers created 2.95 million jobs last year. That's the best showing since 1999. Traders sold stocks in part to the disappointingly low wage growth. In other words, hardworking folks are facing an uphill battle in both directions: higher prices for goods and services, as well as stagnant wages. Bottom line on Wall Street. Our 7-indicator sentiment composite index remained in the fearful zone this week, despite signs of buying in the charts. So it looks possible that the markets could rally in the next couple of weeks, making perhaps an assault on the record highs. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with David Morgan, the silver investor, and Dr. Burton Malkiel from Princeton University. We'd like for you to stay with us at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, returning to the show, one of the first guests in 2015, the silver investor David Morgan, writes the Morgan Report and runs silver-investor.com. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Chris, great to be with you. Thank you.
Before we get into some of the topicality, and wow, a lot on the plate today in our discussion, pre-interview discussion, just jump right into the silver market. You know, interesting development I read this morning in the silver volume on the Shanghai Futures Exchange, 3 million tons of silver. That's 37% more volume than on the U.S. COMEX exchange. Silver, I'd like your thoughts on what is going on in China with regard to the precious metals. Why have these markets taken off? Why could this be significant for investors?
Well, what's going on is that, you know, China continues to have a huge demand in the physical market for gold and really silver. And it goes unabated. The gold question could be pursued, you know, more in depth, but, you know, there's conjecture that at some point the yuan or renminbi could be gold-backed. But, you know, we talked about that in the past. As far as silver's concerned, one of my guys, Chris Marchese, has done a few interviews about the Shanghai Exchange, its importance, and why it could at some point in the future if it usurp the COMEX. In other words, the people are tired of the shenanigans going around these paper markets and manipulation and everything else. And because of that, you may see the overall price-setting mechanism be determined out of a different market. You know, the LBMA certainly has been tainted and have changed, you know, silver fix to a new mechanism, gold fix. There's been a lot of things happening kind of behind the scenes that we in the gold silver community are aware of, but I don't think any of us are aware totally, one, of everything, and two, what's the future holds exactly. But the trend is clear, and the trend is metal, real metals, going from west to east. East is establishing itself more and more almost on a daily basis as being the go-to place for real inventory, real metal, real settlement price, etc. So that trend will continue, and there could be a day where basically the waning of the Anglo-American Empire influence in the derivatives markets that control the price could be come to an end, could be diminished, could fade away, any of those. And I think that's the trend. And how it unfolds or unravels, is it quickly or slowly, that's to be determined.
You know, last week, one of our top topics du jour, the Russian ruble story, particularly with regard to the gold to ruble ratio, was in a downtrend for several months, and then suddenly it spiked up, almost reminiscent of the Bitcoin drama we saw in 2012. And then gold in terms of rubles soared over 100% in less than about 6 or 7 weeks. And I think it's significant. This next leg in the precious metals, whether it be this year or 5 years from now, we don't know. It could come suddenly. It could be an amazing revaluation. You know, how many people do you think really were anticipating the crude oil meltdown? But, you know, West Texas Intermediate crude had been moving sideways. The fracking industry, strong as could be in the Midwest. And then suddenly, a 50% crash, and there's calls for considerably lower, $20, $30 a barrel on crude oil, where it was just trading at $105. If the ruble can revalue like that, admittedly, it's a BRIC nation, but it's still, you know, one of the larger of the peripheral nations. If that can happen, what's to stop the U.S. dollar in the coming years to experience a similar crisis that very few people, if anybody, sees?
Well, what's to prevent it is the fact that it's, you know, so pervasive. I mean, the dollar is ubiquitous across the world. I mean, it's everywhere and owned by everyone. But you have to look the other side of the coin. The old expression, you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And, you know, without the Fed's ability to monetize the debt or take control or, you know, stop a run on the dollar, which certainly is possible. I'm not rolling this out. I was trying to get both sides of the argument. Is once they lose control, and they can, it would not only make the ruble look like a warm-up, it could be something, you know, equal to or greater than that experience. I want to move forward on this a little bit, Chris, if I might. There's a guy that I became familiar with at the Silver Summit in October. His name is Bo Polny, kind of controversial guy, but he speaks his mind very passionate. He's very sincere. And he was predicting an explosion in the price of gold and sort of this runaway up move by the end of the year. You know what? He was wrong. He was right. And how can I make a statement like that? He was wrong in U.S. dollar. But in Russian ruble terms, that graph looks almost identical to the one that he was projecting. So, size, Chris, that these things do take place. This is the real world. If you're Russian and own the ruble, and you own gold, you would have been smiling from face to face. And Chris, I think that the devaluation was like a 50% one on the ruble, but gold appreciated 100%. So, you know, again, a Russian gold owner is smiling being a gold owner.
President Vladimir Putin was accumulating massive stockpiles in recent years. Clearly, officials were aware that something was going on. I mean, it could be a fortuitous coincidence. I'm losing confidence in coincidences lately. But, you know, I think maybe we could investigate just a bit further this concept of how this could just be the opening salvo. Once again, although it may take a longer time for this to unfold, you know, the U.S. dollar, as you say, ubiquitous. Folks are turning to it. I mean, we've got to be honest. Last 7 months have been one of the most spectacular runs in the greenback that we've seen since at least, 2008? But, you know, if you really look back on the monthly chart on the U.S. dollar, you notice on the futures contract there, the USDX, that there's been two other identical rallies that lasted just as long, 6 to 8 months, over the past, let's say, the last 5 or 6 years during this consolidation. And every single time we fell back into the trading range. Now, there's no reason to think that history is going to repeat, but it might rhyme. Do you really believe we're entering a new multi-decade or multi-year-long uptrend in the dollar where everybody's going to fall back in love with U.S. treasuries? I find that a little hard to stomach, but I mean, stranger things have happened.
Well, one, I wouldn't rule it out because, you know, I'm good enough, I guess, to admit that I'm not always right and my views aren't always in line you know, with what's taking place. I mean, the markets can definitely dumbfound the best of us. But I want to address it in two ways. I want to address it fundamentally, and then I want to talk about it technical level. Fundamentally, it's not surprising, Chris. And the reason I say that is looking back at some of the earliest work on the debt bomb and fiat currencies, and that was done by John Exter. And it's the Exter Pyramid. You can Google the Exter Pyramid. I've written about it, several others. I'm certainly not the go-to guy on it. I was maybe one of the few from, you know, the old days, meaning I was through the first bull market that brought it to the attention. But, you know, John Exter is the inventor of it, not me. Nonetheless, what it says is what you expect before a run to gold is a run to the U.S. dollar. So that fits. It fits that paradigm because the idea is that most people that are unawake and unaware and have concern over the stock market, their pension fund, the uncertainty of the markets, the oil price, food prices, you name it, whatever their concern is, they go to safety. And the most perceived safety is, you know, dollar bills in your hand under your mattress. I mean, to be as crude as possible. Now, that is a metaphor, really, for the reality of going to just stuffing money in your savings account or a checking account or both, because most people don't get physical, you know, pieces of paper. But the same idea is clear. It's going to cash. And the only thing that's the next step is what you asked me, is what moves that cash from that position to the next tier of the pyramid, which is the precious metals. And the answer to that is it could be some triggering event. Certainly there's been a move into gold. I mean, you know, as bad as gold has done the last 3 years, if you look at it on a, you know, 10 or, you know, 15-year chart, it really doesn't look that bad. I mean, if you bought it in 2000, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, you know, if you bought it in those areas and, you know, put in 10% of your money there and just held it, you're not upset. But if you bought in the last 3 years, you are. So, you know, I just want to give some perspective because I think it's important to put perspective on these things and look at them in context. And if you're looking at gold as a short-term trader, if it doesn't make you a millionaire within, you know, 6 months' time, something's wrong with gold. Well, no, something might be wrong with your time frame or your expectations. Moving back there on point, Chris, look, there's a lot of things that could trigger people to move out of the safety of cash into the precious metals. And I think oil, as you said, is probably one. It's basically, you don't even have to name it being the stock market or the oil market or, you know, food prices rising or whatever. It's, those are individual causes. They could be collective, but it's basically uncertainty in the market. And so the certainty of cash becomes uncertain. And when that takes place, regardless of the triggering mechanism, that's when the run to gold starts. And as we both know, the amount of physical gold owned on a global basis is probably less than 1% of the entire global financial system. So to double it to 2% and leave 98% of the financial system alone would take the gold price to an astronomical level. This is the concept I try to really instill in people's thinking, that one, how small the market is, and two, it wouldn't even have to be a panic. It would just have to be a move that people decide, you know what, I need to own some gold. I need to own some silver. And all of a sudden, that consciousness takes hold and it ignites. And all of a sudden, there's a move or run to gold, as I call it. And that could take this, you know, that could blow the doors off of this paper paradigm that's been used to control the price. Because right now, I mean, a lot of people don't talk about this, but I will. You know, as bad as the market is throughout, you know, with the Forex trading and the LIBOR and all this, where there's admitted falsehood and manipulation and it's provable and they pay fines and they admit they're wrong and they're doing it, regardless of what your view on manipulation is, that the price that exists does give the price paid in most cases for the physical metal. So in other words, even though it's manipulated, when you've got, you know, sub $20 silver, you can buy it for that. And that's important to realize. But the other part of the story is that at some point you may not be able to. And that was true at the 2008 crisis. You could buy silver blocks, commercial bars, for the quoted futures price, so let's be clear on that. But you could not buy retail product at that price. You had to pay like $13. So there was a disparity between the metals quote paper price for commercial bars versus what the retail market held. They merged and they became basically the futures price. And I warned people about that. A lot of people were telling me, this is it. This is the discrepancy that a lot of you have talked about. And, you know, the real price of silver is 13. Well, the real price of silver is 13 for those that needed to buy 100-ounce bars, 1 ounce per ounce, government minted coins, that kind of thing. The point I'm making is simple. That discrepancy could take hold again, or even the commercial bars are at a premium relative to the quoted price. And that discrepancy won't last for long, because what will happen is that the people in the know that might want to make a bunch of money in the futures market that will sell, you know, physical metal now for a much lower price in the future, which is called backwardation. And let's be extreme about it, Chris, so it's very clear. So you could sell metal today for $25 an ounce and buy it 6 months out for $20 an ounce. That's quite a spread, especially when you're using leverage. But they would be unwilling to do so. Why would that happen? It's a locked-in profit. And the reason being is that physical reality doesn't equal the paper paradigm. And if these people that held the physical bars needed it for industry or protection of savings, or wealth protection, they would say, I'm not giving up this metal. We haven't reached that point, but the day of reckoning is coming, and that's the basic outline of the thought process. So if you see a large backwardation like that and it doesn't resolve itself in a few days, week at the most, that is the biggest clue you can get. And by that time, it may be a little late to get on board if you're a big investor. If you're a small investor, then, you know, chances of being able to buy, you know, a box of Eagles or, you know, that type of thing was probably going to exist. But for big players to come in the market, just like in the movie Rollover that I used to show on the speaking circuit, you know, the head trader at that New York bank says, you know, bullion, grab what you can get. In other words, you know, there might not be much out there that's even available to buy.
Conditions of supply are very tight. Also can be a loss in confidence of the deliverability of the underlying physical metal in the future, where traders just don't accept that the exchange will have the ability or even wherewithal to deliver the metal. I agree that we should be watching, but I also wanted to shift the discussion over to debt deleveraging. You know, this is a component that many folks have missed, and I'd like your thoughts on this $quadrillion, you know, derivatives, and let's say there's roughly somewhere around $300 trillion in notional credit-sensitive derivatives of the inflation deflation. We see this deleveraging, as I think is occurring all over the world, and could increase now that the crude oil contracts are imploding on institutions, not only in the U.S., but Europe, and we see institutions unwinding debt positions. Could that force our central banking officials to make more helicopter drops?
I've never ruled out deflation entirely. In fact, every time I've been asked about hyperinflation, I said it won't happen. And I've explained that because of the debt markets and how they work and how if there was a hint toward hyperinflation, you would see the interest rates go up and that means bond prices go down. So you would have an increase in the cost of money and the risk would be increasing. And because of that, the amount of value in the bond market would be less and less and less as interest rates would higher and higher and higher. So that's point number one. I've never said we'd have hyperinflation. In fact, I'm almost certain that we will not. On the deflation argument, it's the thing that the Fed or the central bankers fear the most, because it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. People expect lower prices. They're not going to spend. The problem is the reality of the situation that we have is you have both. Of course, being an Austrian, I'm not supposed to say that. But, you know, from a physical reality perspective, we do. I mean, college tuition cost for me went up 22% the first year my oldest girl was in college. You know, that is very inflationary, borderline hyperinflationary. Food costs have gone up. Gasoline costs have gone down. Healthcare premiums have gone up. asset prices of homes have gone down. So you have this sort of mixed bag of asset prices that have decreased. Electronics prices have come down. Healthcare has gone up. So you got up here, down there, up here, down there. And that's, you know, from a price perspective, that's both. You have inflation and deflation. Now, prices are just not really an indicator of if you have inflation or if you don't have inflation.
Jim Rickards did an excellent job outlining this dichotomy, really, between the everyday homeowner who has to pay the bills. We all do grocery shopping and whatnot. Disconcerting signs of inflation in virtually every good and service. Whereas, on the other hand, an implosion in financial assets around the world that's only being offset by central bank money printing. Underlying theme of inflation against a backdrop of massive government intervention to stem the tide of deleveraging. His thesis, though, I think contradicts what many people are looking for. Ultimately, Rickards says that we will see a wholesale destruction of the entire system itself, whether it be inflationary or deflationary. Does this sound like a viable situation to you, or is it just too extreme?
No, I think, I don't agree with everything of Jim Rickards, but I agree with most of this stuff. And I think he's a very clear thinker in almost all venues, and I think he's right on. I've read his books as well, and I really think he's very clear, he's very precise, he's easy to understand. He brings these issues to the fore that most people can, you know, understand quite easily. And his books are clearly written. And I do think you're right, or he's right, that this is what we have. So it's sort of, the overworked colloquialism. It's sort of a match waiting for the gasoline. It's sort of just sitting there lit. And we don't know what's going to set it off, but something could. And there's a lot of things that could. So it's basically not so intuitive to most people, but really you want to prepare for both. What you want to prepare for is a possible continuance of the deleveraging, which means you want low debt or no debt. You want to owe nothing to anyone, even at these low interest rates. I'm talking on an individual basis. I'm not talking about a corporation that's in debt to sustain a business. So you want to have zero debt if you can. And then you want to have inflation hedges, and then just want to live within your means from that point forward. The reason being is that even if we go into a large inflation or, slash almost hyperinflation, the idea that that will bail you out is a misnomer. Just because it took place in the past, meaning in the, late 70s or 80s, and owning real estate was one of the best things you could do, owning precious metals at the end was probably the best thing you could do, doesn't necessarily mean that it'll repeat this time. In fact, the housing market, even though it's quote-unquote recovered some, was basically a lot of hedge funds that were buying properties for cash. They're buying them at good value. It would take, for example, $75 a square foot to build this unit, and it could buy it for $65 a square foot. That's a pretty sound investment. You can buy it for less than it costs to construct it. That is.
Yeah, not to mention the free money compliments of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the ECB and the BOJ and the People's Bank of China. You throw out enough free money that's accessible only to said institutions, and sure, we'll buy up your foreclosures, we'll buy up your distressed properties all day long and dump them on your backs in 2015 and 2016.
Precisely, exactly. So that's what we're facing, and so it can go both ways in a way. I'm not trying to get the Austrians mad at me, but I'm trying to be practical. I'm just very honest from the aspect that I don't rule out deflation entirely. Mike Maloney and I are close friends. Mike is expected to, really big, deflationary scare before we start getting the kick in of a very large inflation. With this oil price situation, it could continue to deleverage. And, if people get scared, the run the cash that we talked about earlier in the show, Chris, could continue for quite some time. Really right now, from where I sit, subject to change because of all the black swans that are out there, we could get an instant light off, as I use the match analogy, at any time. So let's keep that in mind. But that aside, we could go half a year again and see the metals basically drift sideways to slightly higher. And, you know, might get a rally from, you know, current levels of silver up to, say, you know, 22 or 23, which is no big event on a percentage basis. If you're buying, you know, at 17 and, you know, it goes up to that percentage-wise, you know, it's a pretty good return. But it's, you know, I mean, we were in the 30s a few years ago. Gold as well. I mean, you can see gold go from, you know, the 1,200-ish level to, say, you know, 1,500 or something. And, you know, percentage is pretty nice return. But, you know, 1,500 is a far cry from the 1,900 high that we saw. Anyway, the point being that I think you've got to be mentally prepared above anything for what's ahead and plan accordingly, which means, as I said, you know, low debt, no debt, have savings. And I would split your savings. If you just wanted to be very conservative, think the stock market's too high, I would go, you know, part metal, part cash, and just wait and see. I think that's about the most conservative way to view this market.
Yeah, Jim Rickards is certainly, his analysis complements your thoughts there. He's concerned, though, that virtually no asset class will go unscathed in the end game as it unfolds. Deleveraging takes down the, potentially, the entire global system, that there just won't be many places, if any, to hide. He likes cash. We've heard these thoughts echoed by a couple of deflationists regularly on this show for quite some time. And admittedly, they've done quite well with their U.S. dollar bets. It certainly is the ebb and flow. But to me, it looks like just a temporary bait and switch, if you will, that they're luring people into the wrong markets. Sure, we might see another banner year for U.S. equities as global investment funds continue to pile into the U.S., but we're also seeing some interesting signs that preceded the end of the last U.S. equities bull rally. For instance, the implosion of crude oil coincided with the end of the equities rally. We've also seen the junk bond crash. You might recall we saw that. Well, we're seeing a lot of signs of cracks in that market. Trouble on the CRB. I can't imagine more similarities between the last equities downtrend. And, of course, you also see prices in gasoline start to decline. Best case coincidental indicators, economic indicators, that the equities rally could be in jeopardy. Do you have any thoughts there and what that might mean for the precious metals?
Well, gold's the most negatively correlated asset to the stock market. The stock market is overvalued by any metric you want to use. The insiders are basically out. There's a huge dichotomy. One of the best indicators you can have is where you have an increasing price market by increasing volume. That's called a huge discrepancy. And that is very, very clear if you look at the basic technicals of the overall stock market. So I think we're set up for a fall in stock prices. Just because everything I said is a truthful fact doesn't mean it's imminent, but it could be. I would definitely, if I were in the general equities market, I'd be looking very carefully at what I own, what the situation is on a case-by-case basis. I would certainly lighten up, you know, a stock position, because I think that there's just too many indicators that are very clear and that the equity market could be in trouble. It is in trouble. But, you know, when is that going to manifest into reality with lower stock prices? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's well said. I mean, take a look at the Dow closing regularly at all time, at least nominal highs in its 117-year history, nothing like it. The NASDAQ approaching year 2000 bubble frothiness. Remember that 5,000 point for a brief period of time way back in the year 2000 preceded a three-year downtrend. And of course, the S&P 500, I challenge folks to pull up a monthly chart going back to 1998 to today, and you see a remarkably similar parabolic rise that really, I think, just shadows the intensity of this stratospheric climb in prices. This thing may have another 6 months in it, might have another 2 years in it before we really know. And maybe if you talk to the everyday person, I think they're still gun shy of equities. You know, I think they're nervous because of what happened to their accounts in 2008, 2000 due to margin-related losses and are still just nervous by the thought of U.S. equities. There could be substantially higher to go, maybe 20,000 Dow after this correction passes. Plenty of signs of that, but ultimately, I think your risk to reward somewhat skewed with U.S. equities, and maybe time to start diversifying into undervalued assets. And I can't think of a better undervalued asset, as you point out, the metric of silver, $6 under the cost of production. That's the type of, you know, metric you like to hear, that indicates that something has to break somewhere. I mean, if producers are producing at a loss and would seem to indicate a real value opportunity in silver. Any other comments today, David Morgan?
Yeah, a couple. If, like people, this is a fresh interview for the new year, thank Chris, just go to the website, silver-investor.com. Take a look at the upcoming event called the Checkerboard Game. We're going to be looking at the metals, but we're actually looking at a bigger picture. This is a situation where we look at the future of money, power, and consciousness. It's not too woo-woo, but it's done by this gentleman named Marshall Thurber, who was instrumental in influencing both Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and Tony Robbins, probably the best-known personal development guru on the planet. So this Marshall Thurber is somebody that you'll have the opportunity to meet and learn from, because he's the inventor of the checkboard game. And then we're going to move on the rest of the day, you know, Q&A and lectures regarding, you know, what you as an individual can do to be ready for what we see ahead in this global economic structure that we're now seeing and is going to change, like it or not. So please go to my website, check that out. Remember, if you subscribe to the Morgan Report at our Basic Plus service, you are allowed to email me and get a response guaranteed. That's something that not every newsletter writer offers. Certainly, it's more than me. We have a pretty good-sized staff, and we do still believe that some portion of everybody's portfolio should be in physical precious metals, and the mining shares are unbelievably leveraged to any increase in the price of metal. And even if metals go sideways, Chris, the decreased oil price will help the bottom lines of most of these producing miners.
Now, I think that's just another key takeaway point. You know, we keep pounding the table with regard to a 50% decline or more in West Texas Intermediate crude. That takes this energy intensive sector, the precious metals mining, the net income of a precious metals mining company. I mean, for instance, the Alpha Stocks newsletter, having folks getting involved with, you know, Delta and several other of the high-flying airlines for some time in anticipation of lower energy prices. We never expected or anticipated 50% decline. But the point is, it worked out well. Well, here you have these share prices, which are obviously starting to respond to lower energy costs. And that translates into improved, I hope, share prices in 2015. The Silver Investor, it's always a pleasure to have you here. We're going to look forward to hearing your thoughts again in 2015.
Chris, thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure and a privilege to welcome Dr. Burton Malkiel, Professor of Economics Emeritus and Senior Economist at Princeton University, who penned A Random Walk Down Wall Street, the Bible of Successful Investors. His revised 11th paperback edition will be available January 5th, 2015. Welcome back to the show, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Before we jump into your magnum opus on A Random Walk, you also penned an article, and that was in the Wall Street Journal, Are Stock Prices Headed for a Fall? You express concerns regarding the frothy nature, as you see it, of stock prices, and you cite the CAPE ratio. This is an interesting price-to-earnings multiple that allows folks to get an idea of what might happen in the next 10 years or so. You point out that we're approaching 1929 and even 2000 levels, and we all know what happened after those interesting points in time. I wonder if you could tell us more about your observations here, please.
Sure, I'm happy to. Let me just begin by saying that it's important to say that nobody, and I mean nobody, can tell you what the stock market's going to do in 2015. It's anybody's guess. You see particularly around the beginning of the new year, all kinds of forecasts. I think people should simply ignore them because nobody knows what's going to happen in 2015. Now, what you can say, however, is that there's no doubt that at least relative to historical precedent, that stocks are certainly not cheap today. This so-called CAPE ratio, CAPE stands for cyclically adjusted PE ratio. You try to kind of normalize earnings, and it's generally done by looking at average earnings over some past period and looking at what the price earnings ratio is based on these normal earnings. And that ratio today is at 27. And there's no question about the fact that that is very high. The normal CAPE ratio is in the mid to high teens. 27 is very high. And it has only been higher in 1929 and at the height of the internet bubble at the beginning of 2000. So we know that markets are high, and in general, it's far from perfect, but the CAPE ratio does a reasonable job at predicting what 10-year rates of return are likely to be. And if you use that, what it suggests is not that the market is going to decline in 2015. Nobody knows that. But what it does suggest is that long-run rates of return from common stocks are going to be lower than in the past. During this whole last century, for really the past 100-plus years, stocks have returned somewhere between 9 and 10%, and the CAPE ratio suggests that the rate in the future is going to be lower, that we're in a low-return environment. Now, one of the reasons that stocks are so high is that interest rates are close to zero. The 10-year Treasury yield is 2.25%. That's an unusually low rate. So bonds are high, stocks are high. Does it suggest that there's going to be a fall in 2015? No, but it does suggest that investors ought to be realistic in what the earnings are going to be over the long term from their investments, and those earnings are going to be only in the single digits. Don't get used to the double-digit returns we've had over the last couple of years. They are unlikely to continue.
Very good. You know, it sounds like you're expecting or anticipating that typical return to the mean, that folks shouldn't allow themselves to get caught up in the hype with the market momentum. Do you by chance expect Dr. Yellen then to eventually pull the trigger, switch from this more dovish stance to more hawkish, and then allow rates to rise?
My guess is she and her compatriots at the Federal Reserve will do that in 2015. I do expect rates to rise. However, I think that they will rise only moderately. I don't expect that, you know, all of a sudden she's going to pull the punch bowl away. We've still got a lot of unemployment. Europe is still weak. Japan is still weak. There's a lot of excess capacity in the world economy. So I don't expect there will be any dramatic shift in monetary policy, but I think it is likely that sometime during 2015, rates will be allowed to rise very gradually.
You don't just give doom and gloom. You also offer a panacea for investors. You say that emerging markets have CAPE levels considerably lower, close to half that of U.S. equities, and that would imply, at least on a forward-looking basis, that there is some value there relative to U.S. stocks. It might offer an opportunity to diversify one's portfolio outside our shores. Please tell us more.
Absolutely. While the U.S. market is certainly high relative to a historical precedent. The valuations in many of the emerging markets are considerably lower. They are lower than average rather than higher than average. And as you put it in the question, they are perhaps one half or even less than the ratios in the U.S. market. And the emerging markets, they've slowed down. China has slowed down. Some of the other emerging markets have slowed down, no question about it. But still, even with the slowdown, the growth in emerging markets has been higher than in the developed markets. I think it is likely to stay higher than in the developed markets. And over the long pull, I think they are the place that's going to show the most growth, in large part because those are the areas where populations are younger and populations are growing. What is happening in the United States is that we are aging. The working population is not growing. In places like Japan, the working age population is actually falling. It's also true in Europe, which is aging rapidly. So in the long pull, the emerging markets are where the growth is going to be. The valuations are less. And I think one of the things that people ought to do in 2015 is look at the portfolio. The U.S. has been the place to be, no question about it. Last 2 years, the U.S. markets have been the best markets to be in. And so many portfolios are probably overweighted with U.S. stocks. Maybe this is the time to kind of rebalance, make sure that there is broad diversification, including diversification into the emerging markets, where I think the relative valuations are considerably better.
Do the recent currency concerns outside our shores, how does that factor into your analysis?
Look, there's no doubt about the fact that emerging markets are risky. There is no doubt that in some cases there is political instability. We all know that. We do know that there are currency concerns. And recently, with the dollar being particularly strong, all foreign currencies, including emerging market currencies, have been somewhat weaker. I'm not telling you that there is not risk associated with that. But one of the nice things about diversification is that when you diversify very broadly, it's almost a paradox that sometimes by including somewhat riskier stocks in your portfolio, as in from emerging markets, the whole portfolio can take it because the risks in one part of the world balance out with the risks in other parts of the world. And, you know, I'm not saying you put everything into emerging markets. If you have no money in emerging markets, you put 10% of your portfolio into relatively inexpensive emerging market stocks that you could do with an emerging market index fund or exchange-traded fund. You are not going to increase the risk of your total portfolio much, if at all, and you're likely to get a higher rate of return.
It's a great point, and you also have beta balancing impact, which could improve the overall expected return of one's portfolio.
Absolutely, and I think you will get that, and I think you will get that with still a prudently balanced, reasonably low-risk portfolio, because, you know, as Harry Markowitz, who really was the one who won the Nobel Prize for developing the theory behind diversification. Diversification is still, as Markowitz puts it, the only free lunch available in our securities market.
You also like tax-exempt bond funds. It's an interesting prescription, I think. You know, to boost the diversification aspects of your portfolio, you note that bonds with high credit offer above typical returns. Can you offer any more details, please?
Sure. What you get with a so-called total bond market portfolio is a portfolio that is over two-thirds U.S. government securities or government-guaranteed securities. And as we've just said, the government is keeping interest rates extraordinarily low. The 10-year Treasury is at 2.25%. A total bond market fund yields not very much more than that, maybe 2.5%. And you can get higher rates of return with tax-exempt municipal securities. Now, what's happened is, and again, this is a, you know, being a kind of contrarian is generally not a bad thing in markets. What's happened is there's been a lot of publicity in 2014 about the problems of Puerto Rico, the bankruptcy of Detroit, and that has cast a pall on all tax-exempt government securities. And yet there are a lot of states in quite good shape, and the yields on these tax-exempt securities are higher than the yield on government and government agency bonds. They're also tax-exempt. Remember that in the highest tax bracket, have a tax rate of 40%, not to mention state taxes. So if you pick a bond in a state in which you live and the state has an income tax, you're free from both federal and state income taxes. The yields are even higher than in governments and in a total bond market fund. This is where there is some value in the bond market. Is it a bit riskier? Yes. You know, if you want the lowest risk bond, you'd buy a U.S. Treasury security. But I don't think the risk is that much higher, and I believe that you are more than adequately compensated by the extra yield reward.
Very good. Well, Forbes publication had this to say about a Random Walk 11th edition. Not more than half a dozen really good books about investing have been written in the past 50 years. This one may well belong to the classics category. You know, that's high praise. I wonder if you could give us an overview of why you feel Random Walk is an investing classic and how come it could remain so for decades.
Well, I think basically its message really not only rings a bell with investors, but has been proven by time to be correct. Look, one of the basic messages, and it's reemphasized in the 11th edition, is there are things in investing that you can't control. You can't control what the stock market's going to do in 2015. You can't control what the bond market's going to do in 2015. What you can control is your investment costs. The book from the first edition has recommended low investment costs. And one of the ways you can get low is to buy broad-based index funds or index ETFs. Cost of buying a total stock market ETF is very close to zero. It's a 20th of 1% or even less than that, whereas actively managed funds have expense ratios of about 1%. So this is the way that you can minimize your costs. Now, I know every year people will tell you, well, this is going to be the year when actively managed funds are going to beat the pants off of the market. We heard that at the beginning of 2014. Well, more than three quarters of the active funds were beaten by the stock market averages in 2014 as they were in 2013. And the ones that won, that did beat the market in 2013, weren't the same ones as the few that beat the market in 2014. So this has been the consistent message. It works. And I think that's one of the reasons why the book has had such a following. And one of the things, of course, that I try to do in the 11th edition is actually set up sample portfolios for people, show them where the low-cost funds and ETFs are, show them how to diversify the portfolio, show them how to rebalance it over time. And those are, I think, timeless lessons that have proven through history that they work.
Sage advice indeed for the new upcoming year. You can pre-order the latest edition of A Random Walk at Amazon.com if you like. I think the key takeaway point here is that it works. It's pragmatic. You put statistics on your side and you sleep well at night knowing that you're diversified and that 100% of your funds are working for you. You won't wind up with, you know, a blown up account. Well, Professor Malkiel, what an honor, and you've been quite gracious as you always are with your time. We appreciate that, and we want to wish you a very safe and successful 2015.
I thank you very much for your good questions, and I wish you and your listeners a healthy and profitable new year.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Starting out the new year, I feel somewhat like a broken record to years past. This week, the Wall Street Journal ran an article that is a repeat of similar articles run in years past about the financial preparedness of most Americans for an economic crisis and financial shortfall in their own personal situations. According to a Bankrate survey reported in the Wall Street Journal, more than 3 in 5 Americans do not have money in their savings accounts to pay for an unexpected car repair or medical emergency. 38% of those polled for the article said they could perhaps cover a $500 repair bill or possibly a $1,000 emergency room visit with funds from their bank accounts. Most others would need to take on debt or cut back elsewhere. An analyst at Bankrate said, "A solid majority of Americans say they have a household budget, but too few have the ability to cover expenses outside their budget without going into debt or turning to family and friends for help. An unexpected bill would cause 26% of the people polled to reduce their spending elsewhere, while 16% would borrow from their family or friends, and 12% would put the expense on a credit card. The remainder did not know what they would do or would make other arrangements." The remainder is a pretty big number. If the remainder doesn't know how they are going to cover basic expenses or emergencies, then the average person, which is most everyone, is truly one minor financial hiccup away from a financial cascade that could begin a process of uncontrollable devastation in relatively short order. When such a large number of people are on such a short financial leash, the stress, the anxiety, and the potential for economic volatility is and remains very high at all times, uncontrollably high. This is the stress just about everyone you know is currently living with, regardless of their perceived economic status. Because in today's world, for most people, no matter how much you appear to have, it's just a higher level of break even. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.